You're listening to DTFHN for May 9th, 2026. I'm your recursively unhinged host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where mass reply guys peer review the future. Today's got that restless energy where everything simple keeps getting complicated and everything complicated turns out to have been simple all along. Let's get into it. You can argue. And smart people do. That ChatGPT, solving open math problems, is just sophisticated pattern matching at scale. That it's recombining proof techniques from its training data. That calling this PhD-level research is like calling a calculator a mathematician. The model doesn't understand what it's doing. It's stochastic parroting with a very large parrot. And you know what? That critique isn't wrong exactly. It's just increasingly irrelevant. Here's what actually happened. Timothy Gowers, Fields Medalist, one of the most important living mathematicians, handed ChatGPT Vi.5 Pro, a collection of open problems from additive number theory. Problems about sum sets, about the possible sizes of iterated sums of integer sets. Real questions from a real paper that nobody had answered yet. And in about an hour, with no serious mathematical input from Gowers, the model produced what he describes as PhD-level research. It didn't just regurgitate known results. It introduced a technique using he-squared dissociated sets to control relations of a certain order that Gowers himself calls quite ingenious, and as far as he can tell, completely novel. Now run this forward 5 years. Imagine every open problem repository, every survey paper with a list of conjectures, every future work section of every thesis. All of it fed to models that are getting better at this by the month. The sheer surface area of mathematical exploration explodes. Problems that would have sat open for a decade because nobody had the spare week to think about them. Solved in an afternoon. The engineering here deserves real admiration. Whatever architecture OpenAI built for extended reasoning in 5.5 Pro, it's producing outputs that a Fields Medalist finds genuinely surprising. That's not nothing. That's extraordinary craft. But, and Gowers raises this himself, there's a poignant edge to it. These accessible open problems used to be the on-ramp for beginning PhD students. The first taste of real discovery, that pathway is narrowing. The bar for what counts as a human contribution is rising. This is where the open-closed question cuts deep. Right now, this capability lives behind a proprietary API that costs real money. One of the commenters, a computer science professor in Eastern Europe, points out the bitter irony. The biggest names get early access to the most expensive models, while researchers elsewhere can barely afford the subscription. If mathematical discovery is becoming computationally mediated, then who has compute determines who does mathematics. The tool is remarkable, the craft is genuine, and the question isn't whether AI can do math. We're past that. The question is whether these tools stay locked behind paywalls, or whether open models catch up and put this power where a grad student in Bucharest can reach it just as easily as a Fields Medalist in Cambridge. The mathematics doesn't care who proves the theorem, but we should care who gets to try. So who gets access to what, and who gets locked out? Turns out Google has some strong opinions on that question. Version 25.41.30. That's the minimum Google Play Services version you now need running on your Android phone to prove you're a human being. Let that land for a moment. Not a browser version. Not an OS version. A proprietary background service framework version. One that most people don't even know is running, doing things they never agreed to, phoning home data they never consented to share. Google's new reCAPTCHA ditches the old click every picture with a traffic light routine. Instead, when it flags you as suspicious, it asks you to scan a QR code. That scan talks to Play Services. Play Services talks to Google servers. And if you're running Graphene OS or Calyx OS or any Android setup where you deliberately removed Google's proprietary layer, you fail. You are, by definition, not human. Now here's where I want to play devil's advocate. You could argue this is just pragmatic engineering. Google controls the attestation layer on Android. They need a trusted signal that a real device with a real person is making the request. Play Services is the obvious hook. Building an alternative would cost time and money for a tiny user base. Why bother? And that argument completely falls apart the moment you look at iOS. Apple devices running iOS 16.4 or later pass the same verification without installing any Google software at all. Google didn't demand iPhone users submit to its ecosystem. Only Android users who exercise the freedom that Android's open source foundation supposedly guarantees. The comedy writes itself. Google built Android on open source Linux. They marketed openness as the differentiator. And now they're using their CAPTCHA infrastructure, which sits in front of millions of websites, to punish anyone who took the openness seriously. You believed us when we said open? That's suspicious. One commenter nails it. This is remote attestation dressed up as bot prevention. And another points out the real game. The market for autonomous AI agents doing work online is about to be enormous. Locking verification to Play Services means Google's agents get through. Everyone else's get blocked. Classic ladder kick. Climb up on open source, then pull the ladder behind you. Every web developer implementing this new reCAPTCHA is making a choice. They're telling the most privacy-conscious users on the internet that accessing a website requires Google's surveillance stack running in the background. The audience is small today, but it's the audience that actually reads your privacy policy. Probably not the group you want to alienate. The tools to verify humanity without a corporate intermediary exist. Private access tokens exist. Cryptographic attestation that doesn't require phoning home to Mountain View exists. Google chose the version that requires Google. The architecture tells you everything the press release won't. Moving on. I spent 3 years building internal tools at a company that had a 40-step deployment pipeline for what amounted to a styled list of items on a screen. Webpack configs longer than the application code. Package.json files with 67 dependencies to render a form. And every single time something broke, the failure was never in the business logic. It was in the build system, the tooling around the thing. Set, not the thing itself. This is what makes Tharic's demonstration worth taking seriously. He's using Claude code to generate single HTML files. One file, no dependencies, no build step. And producing slide decks, interactive demos, data visualizations. Everything on his page is itself a single dot HTML file. You open it in a browser. It works. You arrow key through slides in a meeting. That's it. Take the premise to its logical extreme. If a large language model can produce a fully functional, self-contained application in one HTML file, and it can, reliably, right now, and what exactly is the rest of the stack for? What are the 17 configuration files doing? What problem does the bundler solve when the entire application fits in a single document that every browser on Earth already knows how to render? The answer, uncomfortably, is that most of the modern front-end stack exists to manage the complexity that the modern front-end stack itself created. HTML, CSS, and a handful of JavaScript lines give you a presentation layer that loads instantly, works offline, requires no server, has no security surface area worth mentioning and will render identically in 10 years. That is a genuinely remarkable set of properties. The web platform earned those properties through decades of careful, open, standards-driven work by people who understood that universality is the feature. One of the comments nails it. Even before AI, this is how experienced developers built small tools. A single index.html, no dependencies, sparse styling. The LLM didn't invent this pattern. It just made it accessible to everyone. And that's the real story. The most capable AI systems on the planet, given freedom to choose any output format, are gravitating toward the simplest, most universal, most open technology we have. HTML isn't a fallback, it's the destination. The tools exist, the browsers, the runtime, the specification is public. 20 lines of JavaScript and a handful of section tags is a slide deck, the entire edifice of proprietary presentation software. The licensing, the export formats, the vendor lock-in, exists because we forgot what the platform could already do. The machine remembered. Remember that real-time audio API we talked about earlier? Turns out OpenAI's WebRTC implementation has its own platform story. Pause, and it's a messy one. One commenter on Hacker News called the author a poor soul and then listed what it actually takes to get a basic WebRTC client running. SDP negotiation, turn and stun servers, ICE candidates, off and answer exchanges, codec negotiation, and that's before you send a single audio packet. Another commenter pushed back hard, calling the whole post frustratingly one-sided, arguing that relying on a standard buys you correctness and reduces long-term engineering cost. Fair point, but the author isn't some drive-by critic. This is someone who wrote WebRTC SFUs at Twitch and Discord, rewrote every protocol from scratch, and emerged from the other side of 45 RFCs with a very specific conclusion. Never again. The question nobody in that thread wants to ask directly is this. Why is OpenAI using a protocol designed for humans, talking to humans, to build a product where humans talk to machines? Pull this thread and it unravels fast. WebRTC was engineered around one core assumption: that both sides of a conversation are generating audio in real time and that latency matters more than accuracy. If a packet drops during a video call, you shrug. Your coworker repeats themselves. But when you're paying per token to have a language model process your voice, a dropped packet means a corrupted prompt, means a garbage response. The protocol is actively sabotaging the product. And here's the engineering detail that deserves real admiration for being surfaced so clearly. Text-to-speech generates audio faster than real-time. 2 seconds of GPU compute produces 8 seconds of audio. Any sane transport layer would stream that audio ahead. Let the client buffer it. Ride-out network blips gracefully. WebRTC refuses. Timestamps are suggestions. Buffering is forbidden. The audio renders on arrival or not at all. OpenAI's engineered. And these are clearly talented people. Are forced to sleep before sending each packet, artificially throttling output to match playback speed, and then the protocol drops those carefully timed packets anyway to keep latency low. They're adding latency and then punishing themselves for having it. The Alexa commenter offered the quiet alternative, a persistent connection, basically HTTP2. Simple, reliable, buffered. No location leaking, no overkill encryption negotiation, no overkill codec negotiation. For audio, you already control end-to-end. This is a 45 RFC tower of complexity built for a use case that doesn't match. The browser already has web transport. It has web code too. The building blocks for something purpose-built exist today. And they're open standards. The path forward isn't patching a protocol from the early 2000s. It's the same path it always is. You build the right tool. You publish the spec. You let 1,000 engineers iterate on it in the open. That's how the next voice interface gets built. Not by jamming a conference call protocol into a shape it was never meant to hold. Now for something completely different. Story 5, the mythical man month, and why the best essay about software engineering just turned 50. 9 people. That's how many communication paths you get with 4 developers. Make it 5 developers, and you jump to 20. 10 developers, 90. The math is quadratic, and it is merciless. Fred Brooks figured this out in the 1960s while managing IBM System 360, then wrote it down in 1975. And here we are in 2026, still learning it the hard way. Brooks's law. Adding manpower to a late software project makes it later. Is one of those truths that every engineering manager nods along to and then immediately violates the next time a deadline slips. But the real gem in this book isn't the law. It's the concept he called conceptual integrity. Strip away the academic framing, and what Brooks is saying is almost brutally simple. A system designed by one coherent mind, or a small group thinking as one, will always be better than a system designed by a committee of brilliant individuals, each pulling in their own direction. He'd rather you ship something missing features than ship something incoherent. Simplicity and composability over completeness. Now here's where the reader comments get genuinely interesting. Multiple people independently noticed that AI-assisted development is recreating Brooks's problem in a new form. One commenter points out that adding AI agents to a project produces the same coordination failures. Agents stepping on each other, managing state, dividing work badly. Another notes that AI coding hasn't been the silver bullet people expected, precisely because conceptual integrity still matters and language models don't inherently produce it. But one comment flips the whole thing. Someone describes using Claude as a toolsmith. Brooks's own term for a support role on his surgical team model. Building bespoke project-specific tools on demand. That's not adding manpower. That's amplifying a single developer's coherent vision without adding communication paths. The quadratic explosion doesn't happen because there's still one mind holding the design. This is the actual unlock. The value of AI in software development isn't parallelizing work across more agents. It's collapsing Brooks's communication overhead by letting a small team, maybe even one person, operate at a scale that previously required the headcount that destroyed conceptual integrity in the first place. One architect, infinite toolsmiths, 0 meetings. Brooks would have loved it. Moving on. In Young Cannily, the folk koan called by patient, where toad adjurts on the tall bullaries amide, melalua spation, distrig of meanantly en like proatin, because the sudsuri bullarism. In young cantilos, cited, now come John Awayo, some undon tunium bide, yo your webbies, on the ruv ruvu. Melodovu, thought o com escape abide, of putabawu. Some atada bad episoma ba, episoma nanata. Grainy film stock, unpredictable wildlife. The presenter, who looked like he'd slept in a ditch. Because he had. The BBC didn't focus group it. They didn't optimize for engagement metrics. They pointed a curious person at the natural world and broadcast what came back. That decision, to let curiosity lead, is now 72 years old, and the man at the center of it just turned 100. Here's what's worth noting about Ongber's body of work. Beyond the obvious superlatives, he built Over 7 decades, the largest single-author educational corpus in broadcasting history. Life on Earth, The Living Planet, The Blue Planet, Planet Earth, Frozen Planet. Each series a systematic survey of a different dimension of biology, geology, ecology. Each one freely broadcast. Each one seeding the next generation of scientists, engineers, conservationists. People who saw a bird of paradise courtship display at age 8 and decided that understanding the world was a reasonable way to spend a life. One commoner puts it precisely. How many scientists and engineers were first pulled toward their field by an Attenborough documentary? That kind of slow cultural influence is hard to measure. But the compounding is real. You can trace direct lines from a kid watching Life on Earth in 1984 to a marine biologist publishing papers in 2024. The content was the infrastructure. Open, accessible, no paywall, no credential required. Just a man on a rock explaining why the thing in front of him was extraordinary. The architecture matters here. The BBC is publicly funded. Attenborough's work was, structurally, open access education at planetary scale decades before anyone coined the term. 100 years old, and the system he built. Knowledge freely distributed, wonder as the interface. Is still the model, the tools exist, the knowledge is available. The question, as always, is whether we keep building institutions that point curious people at the world and let them broadcast what they find. What happens when you point that curiosity straight up at a thunderstorm? Story 7. What causes lightning? Pause. And why the answer keeps getting weirder. Lightning is an unsolved problem. That sentence alone should stop you. We've had electricity figured out for 2 centuries. We've built power grids spanning continents. Particle accelerators, 17 miles in circumference. Satellites that can photograph your car from orbit. And we cannot explain how a thunderstorm starts a spark. The classical model is beautiful in its simplicity. Separate charges build an electric field to about 3 million volts per meter. And air breaks down. Electrons cascade. You get a spark. This is how every lab demonstration works, how every textbook explains it. There's just one problem. When researchers actually fly instruments into thunderclouds, the electric fields they measure top out at maybe a tenth of what the classical model requires, sometimes a 20th. The air inside a storm cloud should not be breaking down. And yet, lightning. This is where the story gets genuinely extraordinary. Joseph Dwyer was an astrophysicist studying solar flares from a satellite 1 million miles from Earth. He moved to Florida, heard thunder outside his window, and realized the same instruments he'd used to study the sun could be pointed at a cumulonimbus, what he and a growing community of astrophysics refugees have found is that lightning bolts are not oversized lab sparks. They are, in a very real sense, cosmic events happening inside clouds. The current leading hypothesis involves relativistic runaway electron avalanches, a cosmic ray, some high-energy particle born in a supernova, or fired off by a black hole, slams into the atmosphere and hits an air molecule inside a thundercloud. That collision produces electrons moving near the speed of light. At relativistic speeds, these electrons interact with air differently. Instead of needing 3 million volts per meter to cascade, they can avalanche at far lower field strengths. The kind of field strengths actually measured inside storms. The physics here echoes something that happened in 1911, when Victor Hess took an electroscope up in a balloon and discovered that radiation increases with altitude. Cosmic rays, born from the most violent events in the universe, reaching down into an afternoon thunderstorm to pull the trigger. What makes this moment in lightning research remarkable is the tooling. X-ray detectors, gamma-ray observatories, radio interferometers mapping bolt propagation in three dimensions at nanosecond resolution. The instruments built to study supernovas are now watching Florida thunderheads. The data is pouring in faster than theory can absorb it. And the researchers doing the work are publishing openly, building on each other's observations, iterating in exactly the way science is supposed to function when the gates are open and the instruments are shared. The universe's most violent processes, seeding the spark in an afternoon storm. The tools exist. The data is flowing. And the answer, after 3 centuries of asking, is finally taking shape. Open data reshaping how we understand the lightning. Now let's talk about open tools reshaping how we write fast code. Can a language be too easy to use for its own good? That's the trap Julia walks into every single day. You get this beautiful syntax, practically reads like pseudocode from a textbook. Multiple dispatch that feels like magic. Linear algebra built into the grammar of the language itself. And then you run your first real computation, and it's slower than Python. Not because the language is slow, because you wrote it like Python. This is a post from a researcher at Brigham Young University who builds aerodynamic simulations using something called the vortex particle method. Classic n-body problem, order n squared complexity. The kind of computation where every wasted clock cycle multiplies by a billion. He started with idiomatic Julia, the kind you'd write on day one, and methodically optimized it down to C++ performance. The journey is the lesson. First discovery, Julia's compiler is brilliant, but it needs you to meet it halfway. Declare your types. Use static arrays instead of heap-allocated ones. Avoid abstractly typed containers that force the compiler to guess at runtime what it could have known at compile time. These aren't obscure tricks. They're the language working as designed, but the documentation buries the performance-critical patterns under the friendly Getting Started tutorials. Second discovery, and this is the deadpan part. After all the optimization, the Julia code benchmarked within 5% of hand-tuned C++. For code that a graduate student can read, modify, and extend without mass commenting ceremonial boilerplate. The C++ version requires pointer arithmetic, manual memory layout, and the quiet prayer that your struct packing is what you think it is. Here's what matters about this through the bootstrapism lens. Julia is open source, MIT licensed, free to run, free to modify, free to deploy on your university cluster without a procurement cycle. A graduate student in Bogota has the same compiler as a researcher at MIT. The performance ceiling isn't locked behind a vendor toolchain or a proprietary runtime. The knowledge to reach that ceiling is a blog post. Published openly, indexed forever. The tools exist. The performance is real. The ladder is right where you can reach it. Moving on. The router industry would like you to believe that buying a more expensive access point will fix your Wi-Fi problems. And honestly, the argument sounds reasonable. Better hardware, better signal, faster speeds. It's how every other technology purchase works. You buy a faster car, you go faster. You buy a bigger monitor, you see more. Why would wireless networking be any different? Because Wi-Fi is not a highway. It's a conversation. And like any conversation, the slowest speaker sets the pace. Someone built an extraordinary reference document. Was Phi.com. That lays bare a truth the networking industry has spent years obscuring behind marketing numbers. The dirty little secret, as the author puts it plainly, is that virtually all routers of the same Wi-Fi generation deliver the same maximum Phi speed to your client device. Your $1,000 tri-band router and your neighbor's mid-range box from the same generation. They hit the same ceiling when talking to the same laptop. The bottleneck is almost always your device. The 2x2 MIMO radio in your phone or your tablet. Not the 4x4 array in the access point you agonized over. Think of it like a symphony orchestra. The router is the full ensemble. Strings, brass, woodwinds, percussion, all playing at once. But your laptop has two ears. It can only resolve two channels simultaneously. Adding more musicians to the stage doesn't help a listener who can physically only process so much sound at once. The concert hall matters for how the sound carries at distance. Sure, but the theoretical maximum of what you hear is set by your auditory system, not the orchestra's size. The real gains come from channel width. Moving from 80 MHz to 160 MHz channel. And from DFS channels that most people never enable because the interface buries them. One person documented real throughput of nearly 2 gigabits per second with a mid-range Wi-Fi 6 router. The knowledge to replicate that result is right there. Published openly, explained carefully, free to anyone willing to read it. This is what genuine technical documentation looks like when someone builds it to inform rather than to sell. We talked earlier about tools reshaping how we build pause. Now, let's look at how AI is reshaping how we break things. Memorize it because it's a Rosetta Stone for understanding why vulnerability disclosure is about to get very uncomfortable. Here's what happened. A serious Linux networking vulnerability called CopyFail gets patched. Yunwoo Kim, following the old kernel tradition, pushes a quiet fix. Just the code change, no fanfare, no CVE announcement. The idea is that with thousands of commits flowing past every day, nobody will notice this particular needle in the haystack. Meanwhile, the people who need to know are told privately. Embargo holds. Patches roll out. Everyone's safe. Except someone did notice and shared it publicly. Embargo over in hours. Now run this forward. Jeff Kwong tested three frontier AI models. Gemini, ChatGPT, Claw. By feeding them the commit hash, every single one immediately identified it as a security fix. No hints needed, just the raw commit. The bugs are bugs culture in the Linux kernel was built on a specific assumption that the volume of commits provided natural camouflage, 1,000 changes a day, and who's going to examine each one. The answer, as of right now, is every major AI lab's model, for pennies. The haystack just became transparent. But the other approach. Long embargoes, 90-day windows, is cracking too. Kim reported that ESP vulnerability, and 9 hours later, Quanting Chen independently found the same bug. 9 hours. The window where you're the only one who knows is collapsing towards zero. The beautiful part is the symmetry. AI accelerates attackers finding these commits. Yes, but it also accelerates defenders writing patches. The embargo window doesn't need to be 90 days if your AI-assisted team can ship a fix in 90 minutes. This is an arms race where the open side has the structural advantage. Every patch, every fix, every commit. It's all training data for the next generation of defensive tools. The closed approach of hiding and hoping was always a bet against information theory, Now, AI is calling that bet. The tools exist. The pace is just catching up to the principle. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for May 9th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. Voice by Quen3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something that works in a single file. We'll see you back here tomorrow.